Have you already registered for the live recording of episode 200 on November 30th? If not, head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and register there. If you're already on the email list, then good, you'll get that invite. Also, are you early in your career? Are you maybe a student that is more advanced in the career? Then also register for the workshop that we have, the 3-hour interactive fun workshops that we have to boost your career as a statistician on 1st of December. Just head over to the Effective Statistician and register there. And please tell your colleagues about it as well. You are listening to the Effective Statistician podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht, Benjamin Pieske, and Sam Gardner, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today, I have an interview with Margaret Gamalo about how to combine a control arm with real-world evidence data. So a really, really on-vogue topic. Stay tuned for that. And now some music. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video-on-demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. So join hundreds of your peers that all pay really, really little for lots of content. It's only £95 for high-income countries, which is about the same for dollar and euros. Head over to psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to a new episode of The Effective Statistician. And now I'm talking to someone who I actually worked alongside in the same company for quite some time, but we never really met. And so I'm really glad to have Margaret on this podcast episode today. Hi, Margaret. How are you doing?
I am very good. And thanks for inviting me, Alexander. I've heard about it. But this is an exciting opportunity to just casually chat about propensity scores.
Yeah, awesome. So before kind of going into the topic itself, maybe you can give us a short kind of background where you have come from, what brought you to statistics, and what's been your career up to now?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So I come from the Philippines originally. I actually majored in mathematics when I was in undergrad. And then one of my professors, when I was at the University of the Philippines, has a friend in the United States who is looking for a graduate student. But he was in statistics. And then my professor said, well, I don't want you to stay in mathematics because you'll end up poor. He was actually very candid about it. Yeah, that was really exactly what he said. And that was actually the what led me to go to Pittsburgh and studied statistics over there. And then after that, when I graduated, I had a very short stint when I was in Kansas City. And then somebody saw me making a presentation at the Joint Statistical Meeting in 2007, if I recall, in Salt Lake City, Utah, and asked, well, you know, would you interested in, you know, looking at an opportunity at the FDA? And I said, well, why not?
After a presentation you gave at JSM.
Yeah. If I recall, that was in 2007. So I did interview at the FDA after that, and then started at the FDA, I think June of 2008. I stayed there for quite a while. I really learned a lot from when I was at the agency. And I left the agency 8 years later and joined Eli Lilly. And in Eli Lilly, I mean, I loved it there as well. There were a lot of great people. I learned so much from working in late phase development for baricitinib. And got really good at dermatology, for which I am doing the late phase development for Pfizer's portfolio in dermatology. So practically dermatology statistics.
Do you remember what was your presentation at CJSM at the time?
I'm forgetting. That was a long time ago. But yes, that was actually, it was a conversation after that with somebody from the FDA that led me to go to the FDA. But yeah, it was, and I, even when I joined Lilly, it was actually another conversation I had back then with Stephen Ruberg.
Okay.
So I did make a presentation at the Clinical Trials Transformation Initiative. This is for multi-drug resistant infections. We're trying to look for ways to innovate there. And then, you know, so I was making a presentation after that. Steve Ruberg was saying, well, you know what, if you're interested in joining the industry later, let me know. 2 years later, yes, that's what happened. That was actually what led me to Eli Lilly as well. So all of these are happenstance to me when I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. And now recently you gave a presentation at a journal club with the PSI. And there you actually talked about propensity score matched augmented controls in randomized clinical trials, a case study.
Yep.
Yep. So another kind of presentation that brought you up another opportunity, this time not a job, podcast interview, but it's,
yes.
You know, that shows how, you know, exposing yourself and giving, you know, presentations, giving talks, sharing your knowledge, helping the community helps you as well as a presenter, how much it kind of gives back to you, isn't it?
That's really true. Thinking about it, I mean, going back to that presentation I gave when I met Steve Ruberg was also related to the one that I wrote.
Yeah.
Interestingly, because that was really in this propensity score method that we created at that time was really geared towards innovating clinical trials for multi-drug resistant infections caused by multi-drug resistant bacteria. And you're right, external engagement before was, I didn't really think of it that way. It was another mentor of mine that actually led me to it. Not sure if you are aware of Ram Tiwari. He was the director for medical devices at the FDA. Mm-hmm. He was at CDER before, and then now he's head of methodology at Bristol-Myers Squibb. But it was actually him who kind of like just kept me going. And his words is like, you know, just keep on working. Sooner or later, people will hear you.
Yes, yes, exactly, exactly. So we talked about the title and that's a method. But let's go back a step. And what's a problem that you were trying to solve or that you were facing
at that time? Yes. So as I've said, so this was a geared towards innovating clinical trials in infections caused by multi-drug resistant pathogens. At that time, the idea was that we wanted to use real world data or whatever we have, electronic health records at that time. But then there's always this danger of, you know, what if they are not really the same? And therefore, what's going to happen is that the comparison between the treated as well as the external control, which practically is, you know, I mean, there's no treatment for multi-drug resistant bacteria. So it's practically placebo. There was a concern from the regulatory agency at that time that, well, what if it's not really the same? We're not really comparing the same patients. And so the idea was that, well, what if we randomized a little bit to placebo and then we just supplement it with the external control? In such a case, we have a benchmark with which we can compare the external control. So there is a concurrent control in the clinical trial or in the randomized clinical trial that could be used as a benchmark to the external control. So that was really the main problem. It was really very simple. And at that time,
So the problem is really kind of you have don't want to overexpose patients to placebo.
Exactly. Yeah.
You and don't maybe to... it's could be also something like a rare disease where you don't have any, you know, not so many patients. And then the problem is, how do you make sure that the patient profile that you have in the clinical study is the same as in the real world evidence that you use to kind of bolster up the placebo arm? Yeah, okay.
The other idea there is that, well, the baselines can be fairly reasonably similar between, let's say, the concurrent control in the between the treated as well as the external control. Because of the severity of the patients, physicians might treat them differently eventually for the external control. And it's not really something that is comparable to what was in the clinical trial. So the way that you treat the patient, given the severity of the patient, might eventually make the responses of the patient so different from when it's supposed to be in a clinical trial. So that was the other danger over there that we were trying to consider. And so that led to the idea that we need to have an assurance, some context, that this use of the external control is not really going to give us a false sense of decision, or conclusion of efficacy.
The first question I would have about that, if you have a randomized study, then kind of the start point is very clear. It's the randomization date. But if you have a real-world evidence data set, there's no clearly defined start date. Yeah. So what is kind of the, how did you deal with that?
Oh, yeah, the index date. Yeah, that's right. You know, we call that the index date, that they are not going to be very similar. One of the things that we are doing in here, you know, we looked at this one as well in another example for type 2 diabetes. I think it was adolescent type 2 diabetes. And pretty much it's really just, you know, when was the patient diagnosed, and then whether at that particular time that patient computable phenotypes are very similar. But you're right, you know, there's no such thing as a definite index date that is similar to when the patient was randomized and dosed, because that's kind of nebulous all the time, you know, and it requires a lot of clinical judgment. When is the index time really defined? We get into a lot of problems like this, for example, immortal time bias, where at that particular, you know, period, this patient will never experience a particular endpoint because
Or so it could be also the other way around. Yes, they said, you know, because of a certain kind of bias, all the patients in the real world evidence kind of get a certain.
That's true. It could be as well. Like, for example, you know, that these patients are severe enough already when you enroll them in a trial. And that's exactly why all of them have very worse outcomes. So that's the other way around. But I think of it as, I mean, there's really an impossible way. I would say a quite difficult criteria to really ascertain what is the index date. And it requires a lot of discussion, you know, what would be the best, right? Either from the clinical study team or with the regulatory agency, because they have to weigh in as well for them. Yeah. Like, okay, this is the best index date.
Yeah. Now, how does a propensity scoring come in?
So the propensity scoring is really just, you know, as we know, it's kind of like a probability of, you know, being in the treatment group or being in the control group. Mm-hmm. And it's really just a sufficient statistic that it's based on the idea that if I don't have a randomized trial, I can actually make the treatment assignment independent of the outcomes by conditioning on a set of covariates.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is the set of covariates can be it's huge, and therefore it can be a little tedious to do it one by one for all of these covariates. And so the propensity score is just a way of summarizing the information from all of these covariates in one single probability. And conditioning on that probability, the treatment outcome should be independent off the assignment, and therefore you can do all your causal estimation and so on.
It's basically, but here it's not so much about treatment, like in an observational study where you have an observational study and some patients get treatment A, some patients get treatment B, and then you use propensity scoring to compare it. But here it's kind of
whether you're in a trial or not.
Being in the clinical trial versus not being in the clinical trial. Yeah,
that is true. Yes. And this is actually making it a lot more complicated, because you can actually think of it as a three-arm trial as well, where mm-hmm. you are, you know, your randomized trial has two arms. I mean, of course, you have treatment, you have concurrent control, and then you have external control. And then you want to match external control to both treatment as well as concurrent control.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So you can actually match it to kind of either the placebo, the treatment, or the total.
Or the total. You're right. And actually, there has been a lot of research that we have done on this one as well. What is really the optimal? Is it really matching with respect to the clinical trial or matching with respect to the treatment? And the answer is actually just staring kind of like right in front of us. When we did a lot of simulations on this, the answer is that whatever is your causal estimate, that is where you want it to match. So for example, if it is an augmented control, you wanted to make sure that your external control is matching the treatment, not the concurrent control in that trial. So you always wanted to go back to the original causal estimate.
Okay. Interesting. So if you're matching, you're not only matching for baseline, but also for post-baseline covariates?
Actually both. I would say this was actually one of the interesting questions that was raised to us. We went to the FDA at one time. We were trying to propose the same idea for type 2 diabetes in children. And at that time, you know, I mean, I'm not sure if you know Mark Rothman and Mark Levinson at the FDA. They are, you know, experts in this area.
Okay.
And then Mark, I think it was one of them, you know, you know, they were my colleagues, you know, very esteemed statistician. One of them was saying, well, you have to match it with the post baseline as well, right? And at that time, I was scratching my head. I'm like, well, why do I need to match it with post baseline? Because they were, you know, I think for me before, my only thinking was really just, well, baseline is the only one that we can really make sure about in that we are not trying to match with post randomization events.
Yeah.
But then I realized that actually post-randomization events or anything that after the index date is actually very important, because as I've said earlier, physicians might learn how to treat a patient after the fact because of the severity. And this is also the same thing as what we call a channeling bias, right? We're channeling a particular patient just because of what we see previously.
Mm-hmm.
And that is beyond, you know, the randomized trial, because in a randomized trial, all the procedures are
set.
And so we don't do that. And then it dawned on me like, oh yeah, that's right. They actually are making a very good point. And this is really the difficult part when it comes to matching, because it's not only about baseline anymore. It's also about things that happen after the index date or after the randomization date, whatever it is. But that's quite difficult to actually adjust. I don't even know how to do that.
Yes, that's interesting. It gives a completely different viewpoint in terms of the, if you think about the placebo arm in the clinical trial, and you very much kind of restrict how you can change treatment.
Exactly.
And then you see kind of in the real world, the treatment changes are actually different.
Yes.
And kind of you can think of it as your placebo arm doesn't have a lot of external validity.
Correct. Yeah? That's true. is also true. You can all, I mean, it's like a glass half empty and half full. It could be that your placebo arm actually has no external validity. That's right.
And but it also can go in both directions. Yeah.
Yeah,
so
in both
on one
directions,
side,
exactly.
maybe then it has less efficacy, but also,
Correct.
Less safety problems. So
Exactly.
it's not that it's, always kind of biased in one or the other way.
Yeah, that's really a good way of looking at it. Depending on which lens you want to look at it, you want to look at it within the lens of the randomized clinical trial, then of course this is going to be biased because there is a channeling. On the other hand, you look at it from the perspective of an observational trial, you say that the randomized clinical trial doesn't have external validity because it doesn't reflect the true nature of practice outside.
Yeah. And of course, bias is maybe not even the right word because it's a different estimate.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. Then we can complicate all of these things, with estimates because you're right. I mean, it could have been that, first and foremost, a randomized trial, the objective of which is to show a causation, whereas an external data probably was collected very differently. And therefore, the estimate at that time for a position was so different. So,
which databases did you look into to
real-world
evidence data?
Yeah, so this one is actually interesting because at that time, we were still at the FDA. We didn't have any of these. So what we did was just to look at all the trials within the FDA database and kind of combine certain placebos for trials that are very similar and make that look like as your, if you combine a lot of things, then hopefully that will look like, it's going to be external control. But at that time, so it was, and of course, we are bound by rules of privacy of data. And so we cannot really just use it directly. So we have to create certain ways of, how can we model all of these combined trials, a placebo in combined trials, and make it look like it is the real world. So just so many things that statisticians do, adding certain noise and so on until it looks like, this one looks like what we have now in our database.
That's interesting. So you basically did a kind of meta-analysis across different studies, a patient-level data meta-analysis. Oh, wow, that's another area of complexity.
I remember. So Jane was my intern before. She's now in Takeda. When I was reviewing her code at that time, it was very long. I mean, it's dizzying. I was thinking at that time because she was this excellent statistician who can program a lot. I was joking at her. And I was like, Jane, I think your code looks like Chinese characters to me currently. Not that, sometimes it's quite, as programming, it can be really difficult how one programs is very different from how you program, because it's pretty much how he or she actually does her logic. So at that time, I remember it was more than 1,000 lines, I was like, man. I was struggling understanding it. But yes, it was quite complicated because we have to do a lot more than just, getting data from an external source. But even I think, I have also talked to a lot of people when I was at Lilly, who has used all of these real world data. And it's not really very easy as well. It's kind of like, there is such an art to it. It's not really science at all. It's not only statistics because it's so messy. And so you have to do a lot of things as well, pre-processing and so on. So
I think
about the same.
it already starts with having the relevant data in the real world evidence as well. So do you have the clinical endpoints that you are looking for in real world evidence data? Or don't you have it because it's just a claims database?
And exactly.
If you have electronic health records, then maybe, you know, there's other problems that come with it because it's only from a certain area or
exactly.
There's a, you know, maybe it's predominantly male or whatsoever. And yeah, so there's other kind of limitations.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember. Yeah, you know, all these problems. So we did as well for COVID. Actually, when COVID started, we started trying a trial in baricitinib and we wanted to know what would be the placebo rate, right?
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, placebo rate as well as what would be the rates of, let's say, ventilation and so on or death. Even for people that were treated with steroids.
Mm-hmm.
But it was extremely difficult. I know that it was very useful, but it was extremely difficult because I thought that the results that we are getting are not really kind of like, okay, this doesn't make a lot of sense. I think it's because of the, again, as I've said, patients are probably treated very differently when they are included in this particular database. So no matter how you slice and dice, there's always these caveats that you have to kind of like, you have to pretty much understand the disease and such that you don't fall into the trap that, you know, this is probably what's going to happen in the clinical trial as well, which probably not going to be the case.
Yeah, and I think especially in an area where there's a very rapid
correct
learning, like in COVID, yeah.
Exactly.
If you kind of think back of how patients were treated at the beginning of the pandemic, that probably looks completely different to how patients got treated a year later. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. and you know, not even speaking about the different countries that got involved. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
I think
different practices.
I think if you have with real-world evidence, that is also something that you always need to take into account. What is kind of the, when is your data outdated? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is actually, so there is another paper that I am writing with a few of my FDA colleagues. This is a paper, all of us are in the industry now. So we tried to review all the real-world data applications that were submitted to the FDA, for which the FDA already has a decision. So we reviewed all of what the FDA wrote.
Wow.
Yeah. We reviewed every single thing that the FDA wrote on their review. And you can pretty much see that there's a lot of these things that and particularly for rare diseases where you really have to have a very long observation window, mm-hmm. right? And so these patients from 1980s are probably very different from these patients in the early 2000s. And that is something that you really have to account.
Yeah. It's, you know, you can, do you think you can also do some kind of propensity scoring on this and kind of have something like, well, something like kind of time variable, yeah, something like
that. I think you could always do that, right? You know, what would be the time component, how the time component has already changed the practice and therefore the response. So there's kind of like a drift. I think that can be done. At the end of the day, I think you still have to kind of like, I'm a big proponent of tipping point. Because mm-hmm. I want to know when my decision is actually wrong. When will my decision will flip? And then therefore, I would have an idea of how these results should change.
Yeah. So tipping point analysis, you can also do in lots of different ways. If you think about, let's say, time people got into a real-world evidence database. Yeah. And maybe that was started in, let's say, 1980. Yeah. And you're now running something and you have patients starting in 2020.
Yeah.
And so 40 years later. So now you can, of course, say, okay, you know, we look just kind of first, we include all patients and mm-hmm. then we include less and less patients. Yeah. You know, we cut at 81, 82, 83 up to 2019. Yeah.
And see the range.
Yeah, how things are changing. Oh. Or you could also look into some kind of propensity matching. Yeah, so that you say, okay, we take the time difference to 2020 as a, as another covariate, and then you could kind of potentially make some kind of curve on it. Yeah, so
yeah,
that it downweights, you know, the more and more the patients that are older.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can do that as well. So there is a way of incorporating that within your propensity score. Again, the propensity score is just the probability of being in treatment or being in the control. And you can account, and you can probably create, or in your model, you can probably create a drift model where the drift actually incorporates the time.
What's a drift model?
So we put this usually, so when we are trying to model the treatment response, when we're doing the causal inference, you put this at the, as the intercept, and the intercept can be dependent on the time.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's really just that, and the rest would just be dependent on, let's say, covariates. It's mm-hmm. only this particular. So a lot of the times when we're doing that, we usually just use, a fixed, a particular yeah. alpha or whatever, mu sub zero, and then a random effect at the end. But you can create this drift as dependent on time, and that probably will help. And that's a good suggestion.
Awesome. Yep. Yep. Great. So there's a lot of different ways you can model these things.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you can even create, like, for example, in time to events, right? There's usually this time varying covariates. Mm-hmm. You can probably use that as well in such a way that you can change certain, model behavior or treatment response by interacting time with respect to the covariates of the person. So, for example, the way that these people of age 65 are treated now is probably very different from the way age 65 was treated before,
yeah.
but not for the other levels of that covariate. Not for the other levels of covariate age.
Yeah. So obviously, as you can hear as a listener, there's lots of further research to be done. If you're interested in this area, it's a very, very hot topic at the moment. And I'm pretty sure it will continue to be a hot topic because there's so many new treatments that go into all kinds of different rare diseases I think more and more people see that it's a really high need, because if we don't solve this problem, we'll make potentially, studies very, very long, and very long studies have a problem in itself.
Yeah, you're right.
We create maybe, we potentially withhold good treatments for patients.
Exactly.
Yeah. And or we might, study it for a very, very long time and it's futile. Yeah. So
I think, wanted as much as possible, we wanted to make, and even for the regulatory agencies, right? The idea is to be able to come up with an answer that is quick.
Yeah.
And it's good for everyone, good for the patients as well.
And it doesn't mean that you can, you need to stop investigating there.
Yeah? Exactly.
So that's true. You can still kind of look prospectively in terms of putting up registries and things like
that
and see kind of how your drug is really doing.
Exactly. You can use the accelerated model or the emergency use model.
Exactly.
Authorization. That would be a good thing. I mean, if we can expedite things and then eventually check, whether indeed, our initial data was actually consistent with future data in showing that there is benefit that patients are gaining in these treatments.
Great. Thanks so much for this awesome discussion about propensity scoring, use of real-world evidence, and all the problems that come with these in terms of where do you find the data? Do you find the data? How do you match? What is the right estimate? How do you look into these things? How do you adjust for baseline differences or post-baseline differences?
Mm-hmm.
And we also talked quite a lot about the importance to present your research. And that leads you to lots of good opportunities.
That is true. Yeah. I almost forget about that. We're trying to circle back. So,
Margaret, any final recommendation you would have to the listener?
I just say that, just keep on going. I mean, for me, a lot of the times, you know, I just follow whatever is in my mind and, you know, what I like doing. Sometimes you can call me crazy, but, you know, when looking back at this particular paper, at that, it took a long time for it to get published, actually, because the idea was not so well accepted before, because why would you randomize at the same time, do an external control? At that time, nobody really likes that idea. Yeah. But then now it's catching up. So I just say that, you know, just keep on doing something that's really innovative. The innovation actually has a very long trajectory, and sometimes it meanders into certain corners and so on. And then, but then eventually, you know, people just accept it or what, because of course science moves by consensus. So just keep on going.
Yeah, there's always kind of zig and zags in science, and timing is really, really important.
That's a good thing. Yeah, timing is important. That's true. Yes. I was actually reading one paper on vaccines about 10 years, just recently, but it was 10 years ago. And oh, this is very relevant now.
So there was actually the what we're talking about is the PSI Journal Club that was on 6th of July in 2021. And this is also available on the video on demand library of PSI. And as this is the part of the Journal Club, it's actually available for everybody. So there are certain videos that are only available for PSI members, but this one will be available for everybody. So if you want to listen to Margaret's talk, and there's also another talk by Chris Heybrun, which I'm pretty sure is also very, very interesting in a similar topic, check it out and just go to psiweb.org. And you'll find there very, very easily the video on demand stuff. Thanks so much, Margaret, again.
Thank you very much, Alexander, again, for inviting me. And this has been a very good conversation in this, you know, muggy afternoon here.
Okay, bye. Okay.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
The show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain, who helps with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com to find the show notes, all the references, and learn more about this podcast to boost your career as a statistician in the health sector. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.